Today is Friday. It's December 4th, 2020. This is a Part 11 Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Carl Bowman, B-O-W-M-A-N. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Carl. How are you today?
Good morning, Tom. Doing well.
Great. Carl, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, you may.
Thank you. In at the end of Part 10, you had recounted a fairly large exodus of staff from Petrified Forest National Park. And one of those people leaving was you.
Yep.
Can you pick that thread up?
Yep. It was pretty much the new chief ranger that had come in. Most of us didn't like. He had a I don't know. I guess you could say kind of an abrasive management style. And so it was, even though I thought the job at Petrified Forest had great potential, it was kind of a case of, no, I don't want to put up with this anymore.
Mm.
And the there was just, you know, being the sole permanent resource manager at the park, there were a lot of things that I didn't know. And I'd had lots of training and that kind of stuff, you know, that that wasn't too much of a problem, but I thought, you know, if I went to a bigger park and could see how a full resource management division operates, I bet I can figure out how to do this job better. And so I started applying around, and a job opened up at Grand Canyon, and it was not a promotion. It was a lateral, and I applied for it. And got it, and that was in the winter of 1990-1991. And I'm not sure there was already a person doing that job, and I'm not sure if the position I got was more intended for that other person or not. Every now and then I kind of got the impression that it was, but at the same time I never got the impression that they weren't happy that I was there. So
okay,
that was kind of an unusual situation.
Well, where did that person go when you showed up?
I'm not sure. Hmm. I never met them.
Okay.
So
you think that was like a, well, let's just have this person do that duty as well until we fill that position, then when somebody comes in to do that duty, this person can go back to their regular job.
Well, I think it was more a case of we have a temporary person doing this job, and we'd like to bring it on permanent, make a permanent position out of it.
Ah.
And then when that person didn't get the job, they were gone.
Okay. So they might have been thinking they were going to land that job, but they didn't.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. And like I say, that's just kind of a vague suspicion on my part.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. And when I got the job, I never had any impression that they weren't happy that I was there, or
mm-hmm.
that I wasn't doing as good a job, or that sort of thing.
Okay. And did the job come with housing?
Yep, it did. In fact, I don't remember what the housing rules were at Grand Canyon at the time, but having worked up there before, I knew about, you know, the whole bid process and all that kind of stuff.
Yep.
And so I just, rather than take an assigned house, I immediately, even before I got there, started bidding on houses. And Lori and I did a weekend trip up to the canyon to look at the three houses that were available at the time. And got there right after a massive snowstorm.
Oh my gosh!
Had broken branches off trees, and you know how those, you get a real heavy storm and the juniper starts splitting.
Yeah.
From just,
yeah,
the weight of the snow on the branches. So the place was a mess. But we went around and we're peeking in the house windows of these vacant houses and decided what our choices were, and so that we could bid on those houses. And meanwhile, I was scurrying around Petrified Forest trying to get, all my files in order and that sort of thing for whoever was going to come after me. And
how did that work? I mean, last time, well, you were the acting chief ranger, as you mentioned, when you went back to your resource management job after Petrified hired a new chief ranger. You could just, right around the stairs, you could help that person when they had questions. How did you leave material for the new, would be the new resource manager at Petrified?
Well, one of the things I did was I'd been working a lot in getting information together and that sort of thing. And so I tried to have printouts of procedures that I'd used, and I even went so far as to print out a lot of the databases. I had these big notebooks that were just database printouts, because you just never know how good somebody else is going to be with a computer.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I had kind of a fair idea. The Petrified Forest had hired a paleontologist named Vince Santucci, and he's now the chief paleontologist of the National Park Service.
How do you spell his last name?
S-A-N-T-U-C-C-I.
And what was his first name?
Vince.
Vince.
Vincent.
Okay.
And he was supposedly coming on as a paleontologist, but I'm not sure of all the machinations that happened. The process was underway when I left, but it wasn't completed. But somehow he wound up taking my job instead of just being a paleontologist. He became the resource management person, and also wound up getting a commission, a law enforcement commission.
Really?
So his plate was pretty full.
Yeah.
And so he and I were able to work together over the phone and that sort of thing to at least smooth out that transition some.
And where did you mention he's still working for the park now?
Yeah, he is the chief paleontologist for the Park Service in the Washington office now.
Oh, okay.
So in fact I still work with him periodically.
Nice.
So
very nice.
So we got all set to leave Petrified, and gosh, that would have been right about the end of March. And so at that point, Lori was 9 months pregnant.
With, oh my gosh!
With our first son, and so we figured, okay, well, we'll the moving van will come. They'll pack everything up, and then you can just head up to Grand Canyon and stand there in the house and tell them what room to put the boxes in.
Hmm.
And I'll stay at Petrified Forest, and once the movers are done, I'll get the house all cleaned, and then I'll come up and we can start moving in. Which was a good plan, but unfortunately we got a big snowstorm that night. It even snowed all the way down to Petrified Forest.
Wow.
And so the movers came and got everything packed up, and then the day they were loading stuff up, Lori headed up to Grand Canyon, and her sister, who lived in Phoenix, came up to help a little bit later. But she got up to Grand Canyon and got to sleep on the floor, I think, in her house on Apache Street. And meanwhile, I stayed at Petrified. Well, with the cold weather, the moving van wouldn't start. And so instead of getting the house all clean, I was stuck kind of entertaining the movers, trying to find something for them to eat and that kind of stuff, while they sent a new tractor out from Flagstaff or wherever so they could haul our stuff up to the canyon. Meanwhile, the snow was coming down up at Grand Canyon, And so the next day, finally got the moving van out about 10 o'clock at night. And so I started cleaning the house, and then the next morning I'm finishing cleaning up the house so I can check out a petrified. Meanwhile, Lori, 9 months pregnant, is out shoveling like a foot of snow off the sidewalk so that the movers can unload the van. And then I got myself checked out, petrified forest. We raced up to the Grand Canyon. The movers finished unloading. And then we immediately packed up because we had our first childbirth class down at the Flagstaff Hospital that night.
Oh my gosh!
So it was kind of a wild couple of days there.
Yeah.
But I started work, and just to jump ahead a short ways, 3 weeks later, our oldest son Luke was born. So in that time, you know, I changed jobs. Lori had quit her job with the Petrified Forest Museum Association. We'd moved to Grand Canyon, and we'd had our first child.
That's, I think you hit all the major stressors, except nobody
mm-hmm.
died.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yep. And we had moved our house at Petrified. Was a three-bedroom, good-sized three-bedroom house with a big storeroom and a small garage storage room, and we were moving into number on, I think it was 810, but it's the first house on the right as you go up Apache Street, a little nice little two-bedroom cottage.
Okay.
And so we had been weeding out stuff like mad, trying to get ready to downsize into this little house, and even as it was, one of the bedrooms we just packed with boxes.
Wow.
We just, you know, start at the back, pile them up to the ceiling, and work your way to the door.
Wow.
And that's what the movers did. And so in the what it turned out to be 3 weeks we had before Luke was born, we were trying to get the house livable. But it was a lot of work. What you needed
wasn't in the box in the back at the bottom, you know, which is always the case.
Yeah.
It seems
we had already kind of triaged that.
Okay.
So not anything horribly serious, and but still kind of a mess.
Hmm. Nice.
So
settling in there at Grand Canyon, and you'd already been at Grand Canyon, you worked there before.
Right.
Who was on the resource team?
Well, my supervisor was Linda Mazu.
Okay.
And she had kind of a mixed bag. She was in charge of natural quiet, sound monitoring, aircraft overflight, that kind of stuff. Mike Ebersol was working for her. And then I was working for her, and my portfolio, so to speak, was air quality and integrated pest management and assisting on water quality. And then she also was in charge of botany, endangered plants, and that sort of thing. And I can't remember if she was in charge of or just worked with the re-veg crew. And then other people that were working, Johnny Ray was there.
Hey, Carl, let's hang on a second. I just want to do a little spelling here. So Linda's last name is Mazzu. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And she is now the superintendent at Bryce Canyon.
Right.
Mm-hmm. All right. And then Mike Ebersol, E-B-E-R-S-O-L. E-B-E-R-S-O-L-E.
Yeah.
Got it. Okay. All right. And then,
yep.
All right. So then Johnny Ray, R-A-Y, Ray was working, mm-hmm. wasn't working for Linda.
No. He was in charge of wildlife management.
Okay.
And, I'm trying to remember. I don't know if or who was working for him. Let's see, we had Jan Balsam was excuse me, was the archaeologist. BASLM. She's still there.
Right.
Although in a different job. Kim Crumbo. And he was working, I'm not sure what all he was working with, but he was involved in a lot of the planning efforts.
Okay.
Wilderness, river management, and those sorts of things. He and I actually shared a party line.
Okay.
Jerry Mitchell was the acting division chief. Oh, gosh, who else was there? Jan Reimer was our division admin person.
How do you spell Jan's last name?
R-E-I-M-E-R.
Okay.
And I think she's still in that same position.
Okay.
So those are the names I can come up with right off the top of my head.
All right. What do you remember about Linda?
Oh, she was great. She was a real good supervisor in terms of, you know, she would let you do your job, but she also stayed involved in your job so she could discuss it intelligently with you and provide relevant guidance and that sort of thing.
Nice.
Boy, she just, her responsibilities were just so varied that she was just working all the time.
Wow.
And so she was a great person to work for. She was one of my best supervisors.
Cool.
And
Mike Ebersol, he had an interesting, did he ever tell you stories about ballooning over the canyon?
Not a whole lot.
What do you remember what he did tell you?
Basically, he had started doing that. That business of his was while I was at Petrified as resource management specialist. So
okay.
When I left Grand Canyon in 86, he was getting ready to start on it. And when I returned in 91, it was over, as I recall.
Okay.
And he said, yeah, it was wonderful. But then they'd always land out there in the middle of the marble platform somewhere and have to be charging around on those res roads out there to find the balloon and bring everybody back.
Hmm.
And just turned into just a huge, huge ball of wax.
Where did he start? Did he take off from the south rim and then drift northeast?
I think so. I think they took off like down there near the airport somewhere.
Okay.
And then, of course, wherever the winds took them, but the drift over the eastern part of the park there.
It's a good idea, but man, that would be a long balloon ride. It may take you some hours to drift away from the south rim all the way east out toward Highway 89.
Well, I mean, you know, if it's in the springtime, you could make it pretty quick.
That's true.
So I never got any any particular stories about that.
Just something I've heard about, and I've always wondered about how did that work. That's really.
So I can't give you very much illumination on that.
And Johnny Ray?
Johnny, I didn't work with very much at all until he became chief of natural resources after Linda left.
Okay.
So what all he was up to, I really don't know
all
at
right.
that time. And so we had, let's see, and then, I believe Johnny was also in charge of the GIS program that we had going.
Okay. And that would have been early into GIS.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. Great big computers, great big plotters, and mm-hmm. mostly trying to get the park infrastructure into the databases so they could actually make maps.
Oh, wow. Okay. Okay. And I think you've already talked about Kim. I think you've already talked about Jan Balsam, mm-hmm. Balsom. But Jan Reimer, how do you, is that Reimer or is it R-H?
Yeah.
Yep, Reimer. Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What do you remember about Jan?
Boy, she's just been there forever. And she's just a little bit odd, but a very sweet person.
Mm-hmm.
And she would always, you know, you could count on her to know what was what we were supposed to do. She would, you know, track the budgets and all that kind of stuff. At the time, we didn't have voicemail, and one of the kind of amusing things, she was and probably still is hell on wheels on a typewriter, and we had a little spinner, so to speak. We each had a little slot in the spinner. And when we were out of the office, while our little telephone missed call slips would be in there,
mm-hmm.
whoever called and what they wanted. And she would always, they were on a pad. We all had a pad. So if we got a call for somebody else, we could write down who it was, what their phone number was, what they wanted, and every, you know, that, mm-hmm. and then leave it for the person. Hers were always typed.
Wow.
And so... But she always, you know, she seemed to have, too, a pretty good idea of what people were working on. So if you had a question, she was always a good person to ask. That, oh, I think so-and-so has been working on blah, blah, blah.
Okay, cool.
So, you know, she might not know exactly what they were doing, but she would at least know who the right person to talk to was. She was also, a lot of times, would be my backup for the air quality monitoring stuff.
Okay.
If I was on leave or something like that, and stuff needed to be done, Jan was the person who could, you know, she couldn't fix the instruments, but she could do the routine data collection. Sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And she actually enjoyed it because it got her out of the office a little bit.
I bet. Yeah. You mentioned one of your goals of moving to Grand Canyon was to really further your understanding of resource management and work with a larger team. Did you express that to Linda, and did she try to get you into some training then?
I told Linda that, and I did get some more training, being able to work on different projects and that sort of thing. But my job changed pretty dramatically over the first couple of years that I was there.
And
basically air quality ate the whole thing.
Okay.
So when I started out, I was I had the responsibility for the air quality stuff. And Linda and I kind of shared responsibility on the integrated pest management side of things. And then I was just along, more of a technician for water quality work that was going on.
You know, that's one thing we haven't talked about is water quality. How did that work? What was the? Well, I know you didn't do much with it, but what do you remember about that? How did it work?
Well, we were at that point. We were streams and springs and that kind of stuff. So we weren't working with the
so it wasn't potable water,
right? We weren't working with the water treatment plant or potable water or anything like that.
Okay.
So the idea was to try and get baseline information on water resources in the park.
Okay.
So this was before Canyon Forest Village and all the mega development plans for Tucson, which really amped up the concerns over water supplies in the park. But this was more of a baseline inventory.
Okay.
And so my big contribution on that was that every year in late June and early July, we would do a river trip. And the timing was chosen so that the snow melt would be over, but the monsoons hadn't started yet.
Okay.
And we would go down the river, Leeds Ferry to Diamond Creek, and we would stop and we would sample springs and side streams, some chemistry measurements. We'd do, you know, like pH, discharge, how much water was coming out. We would do bacterial cultures. Linda had developed these solar-powered incubators so that we could culture bacteria to look for contamination and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
We'd do sediment. And I know at least one year we did some macroinvertebrate surveys where we would go into the streams and sample the different insect and arthropod larvae and stuff that were living in the stream bottoms.
Okay.
And given the time of year, it was always just a blisteringly hot time.
Yeah.
I remember one time getting off the river at Three Springs heading out over the hill with all of our sampling equipment.
Oh, gee.
And the boatman standing on the boat in the shade saying, well, my thermometer reads 120. How does it feel up there in the sun?
Oh, gee.
But the trips were long enough that we would actually get acclimated to the heat, and then we'd be freezing to death when we got back to the South Rim.
Oh, my gosh. Huh.
But it was fun because, you know, we got to stop at all these different places that normally you don't stop at, especially below lava. You know, we'd still be stopping at all the side canyons. And usually on river trips, once you run lava, you pretty much are hauling for Diamond Creek. And so instead, we were stopping at Three Springs, we were stopping at Indian, we were stopping at Trail, you know, all these different side canyons to do the water quality.
Nice.
And,
but it was hot. I mean, there's a lot of that's a hot place to be.
Yep.
Even you know, it's nice to, you know, Spring Canyon. Okay, there's a little spring up in there. You know, it's nice to go look at these places, but oh my gosh, the heat would have been something.
Yeah, the one thing we didn't do was we never got very far off the river.
Okay.
You know, we would get up to the patio at Deer Creek. Would be about as far up as we would get there. We wouldn't always even go up there. Sometimes we just do Deer Creek right at the mouth.
Okay.
We had boom, boom, boom. That spur of thought that flittered away. But one of the other things that Linda would do is periodically she would get me, happened once or twice, there would be other trips on the river, and I would go along to just grab whatever samples I could as I went.
Okay.
And so I remember one night, so one trip, it was an training trip, and I was along, may have just been on the upper half on that one, Leeds Ferry to Phantom Ranch. But in any event, I remember I'd sampled the Little Colorado, and this was in spring, so it wasn't so hot, and instead it was, of course, those howling spring winds.
Ooh.
And I was doing discharge measurements in the Little Colorado, where you put a line across the river, and it's marked at various intervals, I think 10-meter intervals.
Okay.
Probably not, maybe 5 meters on the Little Colorado. But anyway, and then you have a little machine. It's called a pygmy meter, and it's basically a propeller that you stick down in the water on a rod, and you take measurements as you lower it a set amount, and then you're wearing headphones, and as the propeller spins, you get a little click through the headphones.
Okay.
You count the clicks, and that tells you what the water speed is at that depth. And then you lower it, you get that water speed, lower it, get that water speed, all the way down to the bottom. And so what this does is it gives you a cross-section of the stream along with the water velocity all through the water column, and then you can figure out what the discharge is.
That makes sense.
How much water is coming down the stream.
Sure.
So I'm in there doing the Little Colorado. The wind is just howling, blowing sand, and all this kind of stuff. But it's early enough in the year that I'm actually practically, well, in some cases, literally, up to my neck.
Wow.
In the water doing these discharge measurements. And the Little Colorado's warm. You know, it's coming out of those springs. So I'm quite comfortable. Meanwhile, my assistant, who's writing down the numbers that I call out, is freezing to death up there on the bank.
I bet.
Come on, hurry up, hurry up. It's like I'm going as fast as I can. But then that night, I had to filter samples of the stream. And the Little Colorado was always a bear because there can be so much sediment in it. And it takes forever to pump the water through to get the sediment samples out of it. You've got this little hand vacuum pump.
Hmm.
And so everybody else has gone to bed. Camp is dark. And I'm still sitting there with my headlamp, you know, processing these water samples. Another one that we had was, this one was not a park study. It was actually a USGS, U.S. Geological Survey, where they were doing a synoptic study of the Colorado River. It was part of the studies on Glen Canyon Dam. And they had stationed crews all along the Colorado River from Glen Canyon Dam at least down to Diamond Creek, perhaps as far as the head of Lake Mead. I'm not sure. And I was at Knab Creek. But for a 48-hour period, we had a whole suite of pretty sophisticated measurements that we were doing every 6 hours for a 48-hour period.
Wow.
And everybody was doing it at the same time, which is why you get the synoptic title for it.
And what sort of measurements were you taking?
Well, we were doing... depending on where we were, everybody was doing work on the Colorado. And then some crews were stationed where all they had was the Colorado. And then some were at the mouths of tributaries. So in our case, we were at Knab Creek. So we were doing the studies on the Colorado and on Knab Creek. They also did that at Havasu, at Thunder River, Bright Angel. And so what we did was, in our case, we hiked down the Bright Angel Trail to meet our boats.
Okay.
And the boats had most of the science equipment on it, so all we had to do was pack our own personal gear down. And then the boats would go down and drop off various crews at their locations. And we had like a day to get everything set up and ready to go. And then we broke up into teams, and the way it worked was, I believe in that 48 hours, I had 1 6-hour sample that I didn't have to do.
Wow.
So we were, you know, you could catch some catnaps, but the sample processing pretty much consumed the 6 hours.
Wow.
Between samples. So part of it was just going out and measuring discharge, either from the raft. streams. And then we had a bunch of sampling equipment. And depending on what we were sampling, so sometimes it would be biological, we were sampling what was, microorganisms living in the creek. Sometimes we were some of the samples were for metals that were dissolved in the water. We would also do chemical measurements, pH, oxygen saturation, all that kind of stuff. And so every 6 hours, the crew would troop out and take all these measurements. And then some of the samples had to be processed immediately. And so we had a tent set up with all the lab equipment in there to process the samples that had to be processed immediately. And then the ones that weren't processed immediately, we'd have to pack up and store away to be transported out of the canyon. And working at Knab Creek, we had a couple of issues. One of them, fortunately, that I wasn't involved with, was we were doing there was a crew doing the discharge measurements. And so they'd strung up a line across the river, and they're out there on the raft working their way across the river. When around the bend comes this big motor rig.
Oh, gee.
And we've got this cable strung across the river, and it's only like about 4 feet off the water. And so they're screaming at the boat, come in, and trying to get the cable out of the way and all that kind of stuff. And eventually how it wound up was the boat stopped just above the cable, and then the passengers kind of hand-over-handed the cable up and over the commercial raft and then back down on the other side.
Good.
So no one got decapitated.
How did you do it? You've got a little kind of cup thing that goes round and round, and mm-hmm. it goes tick, tick, tick when it makes a circle. But you can't go stand in that river because it's going to be 20 feet deep out there or deeper.
Right.
How did you do that?
So like in Knab Creek, the fish that we used was a little one, just like the one that I talked about, the little Colorado that I'd done.
Right.
On the main stream, we had a big fish.
Okay.
And it looked like a bomb, literally, because it was streamlined. You don't want to mess up the water flow.
Right.
While you're taking your measurements. But this thing, I forget how much it weighed, whether it was 20 or 50 pounds or whatever. And it was on a cable. And so the same sort of arrangement where you would be measuring how fast the propeller went, but in this case it was on a much bigger fish.
So the propeller was basically on a giant weight.
Yeah.
And on a cable with a waterproof insulated another cable for carry the signal.
Right.
And then you'd measure the depth and listen to the tick, 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 and then drop it down some more. And meanwhile,
mm-hmm.
somebody must have been a motorboat to hold that boat in position.
It was.
Okay.
Yeah, I can't remember what company they contracted with. But yeah, it was, we had a commercial boat crew. I think there were three of them.
Okay.
And then all of us scientists.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when I remember I was in charge of lowering the fish on one of the Colorado River measurements, and being surprised when it finally hit the bottom, because you could tell that it was I could tell that it was a sandy bottom.
Hmm.
And of course seeing the river, when you see the bottom, what you always see are the rocks. And so it's kind of a surprise when the fish lands in sand down in the bottom.
How deep was the deepest you remember it being in there?
Oh, it was, I think it was only about 30 feet deep.
Okay.
We were not that far above Knab Rapid.
Okay.
And then Knab Creek, this was still at the time when we had the huge tides on the Colorado River from the water releases.
Okay.
And so during the day at Knab, the river was real low. We were getting nighttime water from the dam. And then during the night, it was high. And so our sampling site on Knab Creek had to be far enough up the creek to to be above the high tide on the river. And so it would be the middle of the night, and we'd go across the river, and then we'd have to pick our way through the real thick tamarisk thicket, and then carry our instruments over our heads where we crossed Kanab Creek, because that was you couldn't go up the creek on the same side. You had to cross the creek because there was a little cliff there that you couldn't get around. So then we'd have to cross the creek with the water, you know, up to our chests, holding our instruments up above our heads, and then tromp up to the sampling site, and doing this at midnight.
That sounded like a pretty rigorous 48 hours. It must have been zombies at the end of it.
Yeah, we were pretty tired by the time it was all over. But it was an interesting trip, and as far as I know, we got good data.
Did that ever get published anywhere? Did the GS put out a paper on that?
I'm sure it's some sort of a report. I think that this was back in the GCES, Glen Canyon Environmental Studies, rather than the GCMRC.
Okay.
That it later became.
And that's a whole other issue. I don't know if you want to talk about it now, which was who was going to get the funding from the Bureau of Reclamation to monitor the river.
Oh, and that's something I know nothing about.
Okay.
My water quality days came to an end after a couple, 3 years. A couple of reasons. One is because air quality was taking up so much of my time. And the other was that Linda did eventually succeed in hiring an honest-to-goodness hydrologist.
Oh, wow.
Who could go out and do work on his own and come at it with a more professional, instead of me, who was doing it mostly by rote, have somebody who actually understood all the implications of what they were doing.
Okay.
So it was kind of a bummer, you know. I lost out on my annual river trip.
Uh-oh.
In fact, as I recall, it was years and years before I got back on the river again.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So
air quality at Petrified Forest, you talked about having the machines. When you got to Grand Canyon, I'm assuming that they had similar machines, that they were up and running and someone was actually collecting them and they were working. Is that correct?
That's correct. We should probably, though, the air quality is the issue that carries on. So I guess I could do a little bit about the IPM, the integrated pest management work that I was doing.
Oh, yeah, let's do that.
Because that also dropped out after
okay.
couple of years, and it was, it was actually my least favorite part of the job. I wasn't overjoyed. I was kind of disappointed to not be able to do water quality anymore. But when the integrated pest management work went away, that was more of a sigh of relief. We were working toward having a comprehensive program, but we didn't have one yet.
Okay.
So there were a few of us, Linda and I, and we may have had a seasonal as well. Anyway, we would get the required state certification as a pesticide applicator.
Okay.
The Park Service didn't have its own certification process. We had to be certified in the state that we were operating in. So every year we'd have to go and get a certain number of continuing education hours and for pesticide application. and then we were pretty much just dealing with the issues at hand. So there was one time that I went out in the middle of the night with the Zantera, or actually it was National Park Lodges at the time, Fred Harvey, contractor for pest management, while he treated the restaurant kitchens at the Altavar, the Bright Angel, and we didn't have anything to do at the Avapai or the Maswick that particular trip. I think we just went in and checked with them, and that was kind of interesting. It was, we started at midnight, so the place wasn't open, and we went into the Altavar, and there were some pretty scary looking cockroaches out by the dumpster, but once we got inside of the building, it was spotless. You know, they put their A team in the Altavar, and they were very helpful. They, oh yeah, we think we saw a cockroach back, blah blah blah, and so we went through the whole kitchen area, doing the inspections, looking for. They put out sticky traps. The little glue board that would catch whatever insects tried to crawl across them. We'd check for those and see where the bugs were and that sort of thing. So the Altavar was really good. There was just hardly anything to do there. And it was my first time in the bowels of the Altavar, so that was kind of interesting. Well,
then back we in the kitchen the, and downstairs there, and
so it was kind of fun.
Okay.
And then we went over to the Bright Angel, and that was definitely the B team. Nobody wanted to talk to us. We're going through and doing our inspection. It wasn't spotless. we found under, because we're down on our hands and knees. We're looking for problems, and we found them in the Bright Angel. And then we went down at the Bright Angel. We went down into the steam tunnels.
Oh, wow. What are those like, and where are they, and how, what size are they?
They're not connected up anymore. My understanding is that in the old days, the railroad had steam engines, and most of their stuff was designed to run on steam. And so there were these steam tunnels that ran from the over by the train station down to the Altavar and the Bright Angel. They wouldn't have been. The Thunderbird and the Kachina weren't hooked up to them. And so then they could run steam from a boiler to all these facilities to power different machines. And
didn't they also use those for heating as well with the steam radiators? And I guess that big boiler was over in the powerhouse, and so the steam lines went under the railroad tracks and up the hill and then spread out.
Right. Yeah. And all we did was we went down to the one under the Bright Angel kitchen.
Okay.
And I don't even remember exploring around very much.
Okay.
Just went down there and set off an insecticide bomb.
Okay.
And which was and the walls of it were just loose rock. You know, integrated pest management nightmare. Just all kinds of little hidey holes and crevices where mostly cockroaches could hide out. And so we set off this bomb to kill them, and they just started appearing out of the walls.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, seeped out there. It was like a scene out of a horror movie.
Oh, gee.
But but then we went over like to the Maswick, and the Maswick was new, and had been built with pest management in mind.
Oh, cool.
And so there was just essentially nothing to do there. The kitchen was designed that you could practically just go in there with a fire hose and clean everything. So we went over, but our inspection didn't find anything, and the staff didn't report anything. I got to see the Maswick kitchen, and that was about it.
Hmm.
So that was one of the things I did. We'd get reports on pest animals, usually skunks, where people would complain about skunks, and I'd have to go out and trap them. And we just had the have a heart traps, the spring cages, and so I put the trap out with a can of cat food in it, and come back in the morning, and there'd be a skunk there.
Uh-huh.
And then I had we called them paper sleeping bags from fire that we disassembled, so it was, instead of a sleeping bag, it was just this big paper quilt.
Huh.
And I'd start 15 feet back and hold this paper sleeping bag up in front of me, and then walk up to the trap, talking to the skunk the whole time so that it wouldn't be startled. It knew I was there, knew it was coming.
Okay.
And then I just put the paper sleeping bag down over the trap, and then through the paper sleeping bag, grabbed the handle. And when I picked up the trap, of course, the paper sleeping bag would fold around it. And I never got sprayed. I did have somebody who thought the whole process was real amusing, and was standing there saying, you know, oh, talking to the skunk? Do they ever answer? And so I said, do you want to finish this job? And he shut up. but we would we'd take the skunks out and release them in the woods, and we didn't mark them to make sure that they came back. But the assumption was if we took them more than 5 miles from the village, that they would set up a new home out there in the woods. Whether that's true or not, or whether they actually starved to death, I don't know. But I would always take them out to the Twin Overlooks on East Rim Drive.
Okay.
Because Apache Stables used to do their horseback rides up to the rim of the canyon. And they had a hitching rail up there where folks would eat lunch. And I thought, well, if there's any place around where these skunks are going to find something to eat, it's going to be where people are having lunch out in the woods.
Mm.
And so I'd always take the skunks out there and just put the trap down out in the woods and then grab a hold of that paper sleeping bag and run, dragging the bag behind me.
Mm.
And, well, I'd open up the trap first.
Right.
And then make a run for it. And usually the skunks would take right off, but one time I did have a skunk that just, you know, that's kind of like, no, I like it in here.
There's a can of cat food in here. I'm not leaving.
I'm not leaving this cat food till it's gone.
Uh-huh.
So I had to sit there and throw rocks at the trap.
Oh, my gosh.
Until he finally left. So during the skunk trapping, one time I had to go in the basement or the crawl space under one of the Apache Street houses looking for a snake, which I never found. They had an infestation of bed bugs at Albright at one time. It was just confined to one room, so we got that taken care of pretty easily. So little stuff like that. Oh, and then there had been a case of relapsing fever over on the North Rim, and we did go over one year to trap fleas to check them for relapsing fever on the North Rim before they opened. And so that was the pest management side of things.
Did you ever get in on the bed bug infestation for the employee housing for Zantera?
No, I never did. For Zantera, that was their responsibility.
Okay.
And so they had contracted out with Compest at the time in Flagstaff. Eventually, though, they did change their contractor.
Okay.
And so the only bed bug infestation I did I did go along and observe a treatment in one of the cabins at the Bright Angel Lodge one time.
Okay.
And then the Albright infestation. And that was one where Albright was, Ann Baugh was there at the time, and she was just right on top of it. As soon as she heard about it, she was on the phone with me, and so I went over there and did the pesticide treatment, went over with her how to clean everything, all the bedding and
right.
the mattresses and all that kind of stuff.
How do you spell Ann's name again?
B-A-U-G-H.
Okay, thank you.
And she was kind of like, I'm not messing around with sterilizing. It's all going out to the dump.
Oh.
I'm not even going to try and get rid of it. I just don't want this to ever happen again.
Right. Right.
And that's what she did. So
I would assume that one major problem would be mice, but again, if the house is tight enough and the holes are plugged up, then the mice aren't going to be in there because they can't get in.
Yeah, and that was I wasn't there was a maintenance crew that handled that sort of thing, the structural exclusion stuff. So I didn't have to mess around with going in and stuffing steel wool or hardware cloth or whatever on mice. There was a maintenance crew that handled that.
And then elk. As the years went by, it seemed the elk became much more aware that there were water. There was, you know, certainly the Eltovar lawn, nice big green grassy lawn. There were food sources in there that, during time of drought especially, that would help drive the elk right into the developed area, right into where people were living.
And that was something that also happened after my time.
Okay.
Elk, the couple of years that I was doing the IPM work, elk were really rare.
Okay.
I saw a couple of elk, I believe it was in 92, saw a couple of elk out on Hermit Road.
Okay.
And told Johnny Ray about it when I got back, and he was real excited because there just hadn't been that many elk sightings.
Hmm.
At the time.
Okay.
One of the things that was kind of amusing, when the elk first started showing up in the park, I guess the first real sightings of them was in the latest 80s, like 1988, 1989 or something like that. In the early 90s, the elk that we had, virtually all the males had one elk type massive antler. And then they also had this, the other antler would be this dweeby, shriveled up sort of thing.
Huh.
And it's kind of like, how do you get any girls with that? But it was...
That seems very odd. Hmm.
Yeah. It must have been the initial population was guys that couldn't make it down in the Williams and Flagstaff area where there was real competition.
Okay.
And eventually, you know, now the elk up there look like elk, but for those first few years, it seemed like a lot of the bulls were not
interesting,
not the most magnificent specimens. But yeah, eventually, we did get a person. His first name was Jerry. I can't remember his last name. But he had been the IPM person for Southwest Region out of Santa Fe, and I'm not sure why he was working for us. I think he was just doing it part-time, easing into retirement or something like that.
Okay.
And so he took over the IPM and pretty much just left me with the air quality work.
Okay.
So I guess we can start into that.
What do we got? We are, you know what? We're right on the hour. Maybe this is a good place to put in a comma here, and then we'll pick up again with air quality.
Okay, and then once we get into air quality, that's going to pretty much carry me through the rest of my resource management career. Because, like I said, that was the the responsibility that ate my job.
So. Wow. Okay. Well, I'm looking forward to hearing about how did that happen. All right, so with that, this will conclude Part 11, Oral History with Carl Bowman, B-O-W-M-A-N. My name is Tom Martin. Today is Friday, December 4th, 2020. Carl, thank you so very much.
No problem at all.